loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the federal government shut down briefly last night. You probably didn't notice it. In the middle of the night, Congress passed a two-year funding measure that adds another $300 billion in spending, more than half of that for the Pentagon, and it keeps the rest of the government open until March 23rd. Next, with the passage of the budget deal, Congress will now take up the issue of immigration reform. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has called for debate to begin on immigration on Monday, with the Senate using the House's Hurd-Aguilar proposal as a starting point. Then, years of war and violence have left 750,000 children in Mosul, northern Iraq, without basic health care. UNICEF recently announced that while appealing for $17 million to aid the area. Less than 10% of health facilities in the surrounding province are operating at full capacity. Despite this great need, there is little to no mention of it in the corporate media. And then, according to multiple reports, Israeli police authorities are recommending to the country's Minister of Justice that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be indicted on a myriad of corruption and bribery charges. The recommendation was made unanimously by a panel of police chiefs. And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. And in our second hour, we'll talk about the news of the day. But first, we look at the government shutdown. The federal government shut down briefly last night. You probably did not notice it. In the middle of the night, Congress passed a two-year funding measure that adds another $300 billion in spending, more than half of that for the Pentagon. And this keeps the rest of the government open until March 23rd. The vote in the House saw 73 Democrats voting yes and 67 Republicans voting no. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced that the Senate would begin debate on Monday on a new immigration bill, as he had promised Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. The Senate will use the House's Hurd-Aguilar bill as a starting point. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Thanks for joining us, Ted.
Thanks for having me.
Ted, this is being trumpeted in the press as a great victory for both sides, the triumph of bipartisanship. This is really just a continuing resolution, though, isn't it? It only kicks the can down the road until March 23rd, except for the Pentagon. Isn't that right?
Well, I'm kind of hoping that we can move into continuing resolutions that last just a few minutes at a time so that we can have the government open and close almost just like a quantum singularity to become something that physicists study and just marvel at. It'll probably help boost our scientific output in the world.
It's a good point because it's an unusual function of government. The main job of these 535 highly paid people is to not have the government that they're supposedly presiding over shut down, as it continually threatens to do. When was the last time there was like a long-term budget that came through on the first take?
1997.
Okay, so that's 21 years.
Yep.
Ted, I know this is kind of a stretch, but I'm starting to think Congress is just a talk shop.
Well, not a very good one. Apparently, there's not a lot of talking that takes place in Washington outside of Trump's Twitter account. And the thing that's crazy is that the Democrats aren't willing to really to make a stand, for example, on DACA and the Dreamers to the point of letting the government stay shut down. But at the same time, they're not willing to they're not willing to completely let it go. It seems like what passes for politics, at least on the Democratic side these days, is more like, we don't really care about this issue a lot, but we're really going to grumble and make some noise. And we'll get credit for that, won't we? And spoiler alert, no, you won't.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, the thing that's so interesting to me and disappointing is that these 535 overseers that we have on Capitol Hill are crowing today about how well they did and how great this is for the country. In fact, we've got an additional, $1 trillion now that we're looking at that we're adding to our national debt. And as I said, they've just kicked the can down the road until March 23rd. At least Mitch McConnell has promised this debate on immigration. we've been saying on this show, Ted, that that was all fine and good, but there was no such promise on the House side. Paul Ryan never told Nancy Pelosi there would be a debate on immigration. That may change with Herb Aguilar. What do you think? You think we'll have a real debate on immigration coming up?
Well, I hope the dreamers that the Democrats know in Washington or who are out there for the Democrats' sake are different than the ones I know, who are all very smart and educated, because they pretty much have to forget about the existence of the House of Representatives to believe that the Democrats are doing a credible job fighting for them. Obviously, what good does it do if you get a deal in the Senate, even assuming that, you know, there's a huge difference between McConnell saying that there will be a bill to debate versus there will be a bill that passes. Those are two very different things. But even if you accept that it's going to, even if it passes, what good does it do without having the House on their side, having something in the House too? They won't have a deal in the House. The thing is, I would say it's all smoke and mirrors, but everyone can see right through it. So I don't even get it.
Let's change subjects.
Sure.
You know, we've talked about the government shutdown for weeks.
It's a dead horse and we've been beating on it for weeks.
Gosh, you know, when you beat a dead horse that long, anyway, it doesn't matter. But Ted, let me ask you a serious question, because I know you have a longstanding relationship with the Los Angeles Times. You were a cartoonist for the Los Angeles Times. They didn't treat you well. You sued them. But now, talk about the new drama with the Los Angeles Times and your own view of it.
Well, so what's interesting is that back in the early aughts, Tribune Publishing, which was the Chicago Tribune, which later was renamed something called Tronc, bought the LA Times. And they've pretty much driven it into the ground from a management point of view ever since. And there have been constant parade of new editors and publishers over the years. The most recent publisher was recently accused of sexual harassment, Me Too violations, but then Tronc looked into it and claimed that he was not guilty. I personally was the cartoonist from 2009 to 2015. They fired me as a favor to the LAPD, and I'm suing them over that because I did cartoons against the LAPD, and the LAPD ginned up some stuff that I later proved not to be true that libeled me. And so without going down the rabbit hole of my lawsuit,
I think that's against the rules of our democracy, Ted. You're not supposed to do cartoons that depict the police in Los Angeles in a bad light. Shame on you.
What's really funny is I keep thinking about, like, you know, cops are cartoon gold going back hundreds of years. So, you know, going back to the 1800s. So it's kind of weird that suddenly it's become a problem now. But anyway, the thing is, so now there's a new guy in charge. Tronc is worth about between $400 and $500 million. And the LA Times is worth between 30 and 40% of Tronc. And they sold the LA Times to this guy, the CEO of a healthcare company. He's worth about $7 billion. He's a local Angeleno tycoon. And he supposedly is going to bring back local ownership, whatever that means. I don't even know if that's important. The question is really, is the ownership benevolent or not? But anyway, it's going to be it's a very Jeff Bezos-like situation in that the Amazon CEO purchasing the Washington Post as an individual. And he radically overpaid for this property. He paid $500 million. In other words, he probably should have paid about $200 million. And he paid $500 million plus about, I think, 80 or 90 million to assume pension liabilities. So he really wanted this thing, and nobody really knows what he wants to do with it. He's making all the right noises about, you know, I care about journalism, I like journalists, but no one knows what that means. You know, but Jeff Bezos said the same thing. And the truth is that the Washington Post, except for its dirty dealings with the CIA, hasn't really much changed as a product.
It's still
Bezos
bad.
Took over.
It's still awful. I hear you. It still has a neocon editorial page. The fact that billionaire Jeff Bezos, with his $600 million contract with the CIA, owns it, he hasn't made it better, but maybe he hasn't made it worse, because that's a low bar.
Yeah, it's a low bar. You know, I've followed the LA Times for many years. The first op-ed I ever wrote was published in the LA Times, so I kind of have a soft spot for the LA Times. But it's been an upheaval for years. I know a guy, I worked for a guy who had been an editor at the LA Times and was and was unceremoniously thrown out because, as it turned out, he was an Armenian Holocaust denier. And you can't be an Armenian Holocaust denier in Los Angeles, California, which has the largest concentration of Armenians outside of Armenia. But this is kind of typical of these odd problems that the LA Times has found itself with over the last 15 years or so.
And what about the workers and the reporters and the people, you know, the staff there at the LA Times? Go ahead, Ted.
Well, they've been, you know, the staff has been gutted. At one time, there were over, I believe, about 1,500 overall staff, including reporters at the LA Times in that big office downtown. And now it's down to about 400. And I think it's possible sometimes to cut and be more efficient, but you go to a point, where you've cut down to the bone and you're no longer doing all the work you should do. Now, I think if you looked at the LA Times in the mid 1990s, it was the best news. I used to call it the best full service newspaper in the mm-hmm. United States because mm-hmm. unlike the New York Times, it had comics and crossword puzzles and advice columns and astrology. It had all that stuff that you like, those features that you like to have in a daily paper, but it also had foreign bureaus in Afghanistan and very strong international coverage.
And real investigative journalism.
Absolutely. So obviously they had some shortcomings. You can ask Gary Webb about those. But there's, but nevertheless, it was a good full-service newspaper, in some ways better than the New York Times because it had all that stuff I mentioned. But it has been just gutted ever since this guy Sam Zell took over Chicago Tribune and Tribune bought it. I mean, you know, anyone who's ever worked for a dysfunctional organization knows that the rot comes from the top. And sometimes it comes down to personality. You know, it's hard to quantify. You can't really systemically say, well, this, if we created a system with this kind of ownership, you'd have a better organization. It's just like sometimes people are just jerks and idiots, and they push out the smart people. That's the part that's really disturbing, is I've seen people, the most talented people, the people who were the smartest, most forward-looking, ended up being threatening to the higher-ups there and at other organizations, but at the LA Times in particular, and they got pushed out. So it's literally kind of an idiocracy there in the at the upper echelons of management and middle management. It's, you know, I think the reporters are long-suffering, which is why they recently voted overwhelmingly for the very first time to be represented by a union. I would argue it's about 50 years too late for it to do any good. I mean, it's not like they're going to go on strike, right? But they should.
Yeah, they should. Well, it's a new day in Los Angeles for the LA Times. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, Ted. That was Ted Rall. He joined us from New York. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
With passage of the budget deal, Congress will now take up the issue of immigration reform. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has called for debate to begin on immigration on Monday, with the Senate using the House's Herd Aguilar proposal as a starting point. McConnell said that he will allow unlimited amendments to the Senate bill in an effort to attract the 60 votes necessary for passage. We're joined from New York by Angie Kim. She is an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Minh Quan Center for Community Action. Angie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me again. Thank you.
Angie, it seems that Mitch McConnell is going to keep his promise to the Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer, to allow some sort of immigration bill to come to the floor. Now, we already know that John McCain and Chris Coons, a Republican and a Democrat, have a bill mm-hmm. that's very similar to one in the House called the Herd-Aguilar bill. Do you think mm-hmm. that these two bills are good starting points? Will they do enough to protect Dreamers? And what do you think about their chances for passage in one form or another?
So the Herd-Aguilar bill is something that on slightly earlier than Senator McCain's bill. I believe that came out just last week. It is true those two bills are more on, you know, the liberal side of things. And, you know, it is slightly immigrant friendly is sort of the word that I've been using. However, we do need 60 votes in the Senate to pass. And then also we have you know, the battle in the House. You know, as much as I would like to be to remain optimistic, I think we do have a long hurdle and challenges up ahead. But, you know, as always, I've mentioned that the immigrant community has, you know, their resilience has been and profound, and it's something that I always can count on. So we're going to continue the fight and make sure that, you know, we're going to push through the challenges that we've seen, obviously, with a lot of the gridlocks happening in the Congress.
You know, another thing that that has been in the news that was not at all addressed in the continuing resolution that was passed last night was money for this this border wall. I was interested to see in Vox today that where the White House wants $25 billion, I guess they're down from $30 billion. The Graham-Durbin bill, which was released several weeks ago, offered only $1.6 billion. But the McCain-Coons bill offers nothing for a wall, and instead it proposes only a study of border needs. What do you think the opinion is among Republicans to not funding a wall and instead focusing on actual immigration reform and then just maybe addressing the border at some later point?
Well, I think I've said this, you know, many times over on your show that, you know, not just the Democratic congressional leaders, but majority of the Republicans have, you know, also expressed their, disapproval with a wall. Not only is it costly for the country, but you know, it's a waste of time. And we all know that the wall has been more or less a symbolic, you know, campaign promise. You know, for President Trump. So I have been, you know, agreeing with a lot of the comments that were coming from the Republican leaders as well, that to build a wall is not, any gain for the country. And, you know, I think that that is the majority opinion, not just in Congress, but for the majority of Americans as well.
Angie Kim is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. The agreement that keeps the government going, the budget agreement, does not have any provision to protect the Dreamers. And of course, for people who have been championing the cause of the Dreamers, and of course, they and their families first and foremost, this was another, I would say, bitter disappointment, a lot of anger. The Democratic Party and Nancy Pelosi in particular made an 8-hour long speech on the House floor, something that's referred to frequently in the media, something unprecedented. But nonetheless, there was no actual effort on the part of the Democrats to vote this down without the support of the Dreamers. And so there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of anger. I would like you to talk about that, Angie. But before we do, I also want you to address specifically what General John Kelly, Donald Trump's chief of staff, said about the Dreamers. And John Kelly said the notable difference, as he put it, between the 690,000 young people who registered for DACA and the larger number, another 1 million plus people who didn't, is that he said some people say that they were too afraid to sign up, that extra million. Others would say they were too lazy to get off their asses, but they didn't sign up. In other words, it showed real animus and hostility from Kelly's statement. But why would others who could have registered, why would they have not registered? What are the different factors?
Absolutely, and I really appreciate the opportunity for me to respond to John Kelly's statement. I think I've actually also made a statement to one of the another reporter asking the same question, and I can tell you exactly what the issues are around. First of all, the application process in itself is a very rigorous and complicated application. It's not as simple as people imagine it to be. It does require a rigorous and very vexing a vetting system where there's a lot of background, check that's required. So a biometric is part of the process that a doctor recipient would have to go through where they go in for an appointment and get their fingers printed and have initially registered themselves with the government. The application in itself is also very costly. There's a $495 application fee that is applied to for the employment authorization that comes along with a deferred action application. So you're looking at not only a very complicated process that would be something that a normal civilian would have a difficulty fathoming, but it does require some legal assistance. So you're looking at underprivileged, low-income immigrant families and individuals having to find legal support, funds for legal support, as well as the $495 application fee. That alone in itself will eliminate a lot of the applicants. And there's so many other numerous reasons as to why not all 1.8 million, eligible young immigrants would apply. And there's also a lot of cases where they do apply and they're essentially denied of their application. So, I've said this over and over again, and I know that this statement has come up recently, and I am very appalled because I know exactly what the process is like. I've gone through it, three times since the DACA program was initiated back in 2012, and this is not something that normal civilian could complete. And so, for the ignorance of John Kelly to make that kind of statement and call immigrants lazy is a racist, ignorant remark. And I'm nothing but appalled and upset as to how he portrayed these young undocumented immigrants, including myself.
Certainly, you can make the argument that the least lazy, quote unquote, part of the population in the country are immigrant families.
Yeah, they're clearly the hardest working people in the country.
Yeah. And we have 1 minute left, Angie. Again, we've done this before on our show, but many people will be hearing you for the first time on 105.5 or 1390 AM. We have 45 seconds left. Talk about how you got here and what your situation is and what you're facing. Go ahead, 45 seconds, if you would.
Absolutely. I came to the country when I was 9 years old with my family from South Korea. My parents actually did try to adjust our status, but the broken immigration didn't allow us to. So now I'm 34. I've been undocumented for 25 years living in New York City, and I received my DACA when I was 29 years old. And I'm part of the resilient undocumented community who have been tirelessly fighting for our constitutional basic human rights, and I'm just proud to be a part of this amazing group of communities and people.
Yeah, I agree. The dreamers and the immigrant families who are doing this, they're part of the legacy of resistance in America. The Dr. Martin Luther King,
right.
We're marking the 50th anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign, 50 years since Dr. King was killed. This is the same sort of grassroots, sometimes civil disobedience action, but mass protest action that has even made any possibility of relief available, because even President Obama, if it hadn't been for the dreamers themselves, their unity, their determination, their ability to convince large parts of the population that their cause is just, if
That's
it
right.
wasn't for them, we wouldn't even be here on the verge of what might be an important immigration reform.
That's right. I'm proud of my immigrant past, and many of my family members came here as undocumented immigrants. And, like Angie and her family and so many thousands and thousands of others, all they wanted to do was work, pay their taxes, and feed their families.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from New York by Angie Kim. She is an immigrant rights advocate. She's a dreamer herself, and she's also a community organizer with the Min Kwan Center for Community Action. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Years of war and violence have left 750,000 children in Mosul, Iraq, without basic health care. That's according to UNICEF. We're joined from London by Catherine Shockdom, a political commentator and analyst focusing on the Middle East. She is the author of A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Catherine Shockdom, thanks so much for joining us once again.
It's always a pleasure.
UNICEF recently announced that it needs at least $17 million in additional aid for the area. Less than 10% of health facilities in the surrounding province where they're operating are operating at full capacity. Despite the great need, there is little or no mention of it in the corporate-owned media, at least here in the United States. I mean, this is a tragedy of the first magnitude.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It is, and it was preventable to an extent, because of course nobody could predict that, you know, Daesh would devastate Iraq the way it did. But at the same time, I think that the writing was on the wall, you know, since beginning of 2001 when the US decided to invade, because there was a complete collapse of, you know, all state infrastructures. So it was very easily manageable back then. But then there's been some kind of a vacuum, and I think that because of dismissal of warnings and because people simply didn't care about, you know, the humanitarian side of this war or to even to try to better Iraqis' lives in general. So, you know, things just went on and they degraded very quickly. And due to, you know, invasion and a breakdown of the economy and the social fabric of the country, and then, you know, of course, Daesh, then everything went from, you know, a bad situation to a very, very bad situation where now people are actually dying, where, you know, entire regions have been completely devastated. And it's an issue because, you know, this leads to further instability. So we can't continue to look at humanitarian crisis as if it is something that, you know, only, you know, bleeding heart we talk about Democrats. It has to do with the fact that it's a political and a national security matter now. We have to understand that there is a relationship in between social collapse and the humanitarian crisis and, of course, you know, security, national security, and how it impacts the rest of the world. And I think this is something that we don't grasp yet. I think that for whatever reason, we think that dealing with the humanitarian side of things makes you automatically a weak leader, that it's not an issue that, you know, state officials, for example, should focus on. But I think it's a mistake. I think that everything should be done to fix that problem. Otherwise, you know, further instability is going to pop up. And the likes of Daesh could actually even re-manifest, maybe under a different face or under a different flag. But, you know, that could breed further radicalism, instability, or other, you know, metamorphoses of Daesh, something similar.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I was in Mosul in September 2002. Mm-hmm. It was a, you know, second or third largest city in Iraq. It was a beautiful city. It was a multi-ethnic, multi-religious city. Had a large Christian population as well as the Muslim population there. I was there because I was documenting, along with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, relentless bombing by the United States of cities all around and towns all around Iraq. This was before the war started, before the March 19th, 2003 shock and awe invasion of Iraq. And so the U.S. had bombed Mosul, and we went there and we documented and we talked to the people whose family members had been killed or harmed or wounded. But one thing that stood out for me, because I had been to other parts of Iraq earlier in the 1990s, but what stood out to me about Mosul was how beautiful it was, how big it was, how vibrant it was. And when you think now that, according to UNICEF, here we are 15 years after the shock and awe invasion of Iraq, as many as 750,000 children just in this town, just in this city, and a lot of people have already left the area because of Daesh or because of the war or earlier wars. When you think about it, it's obviously not only something that can be remediated right now if the world or if the United States, for instance, paid attention to it, but there should also be accountability for what's happened to that city. And in fact, there's no accountability. It just was like America and the American media was all about Iraq as long as the U.S. was going to invade Iraq. Mm-hmm. But as soon as that wasn't the issue, it appears that they don't give a damn about the people in Iraq. And of course, how can that end up with any other consequence than the people in Mosul and the people throughout the country of Iraq, recognizing that all of this death and destruction isn't simply the problem of Daesh, as awful as Daesh is. It's really the problem of those who invaded and fragmented their country.
I agree with you. I 100% agree with you. But again, you know, I think this is the main problem, is that, you know, the dynamics back in 2001 was that of, you know, liberation. America was coming to defeat, you know, Saddam Hussein and to basically give the country back to his people. That was the narrative sold to the public anyway. But it never really happened, because then, you know, this liberation turned into some kind of, you know, military interventionism and then occupation. And, you know, people might try to rationalize, justify. It's not the point. The point is not whether we agree or not with it, because it happened. But I think that, as you mentioned, we have failed in recognizing that, you know, this military intervention in Iraq, whichever reason, you know, was on, you know, what was given or underpinned this mobilization, led to a breakdown of the social social fabric of Iraq, you know, the finances of Iraq, and it led to, you know, a humanitarian catastrophe. And because we haven't, I don't think that Washington actually was willing to hold its end of the deal and say, we contributed to creating that situation, even though it's not what we meant to do, this what happened. Nothing was set in place to try to address the situation, or even to try to somehow to prevent a vacuum from forming, and it formed. And now we're dealing with the consequences of, I think, over a decade of mismanagement and I don't care type of attitude, where, you know, when it comes to liberating the country or claiming victory, then, you know, America is very willing to do that. But when it comes to actually trying to reconstruct Iraq and helping and accompanying Iraqis when it comes to rebuilding the country, then no one is home. And I think it's profoundly unfair, because you can't, you know, rip the benefits of victory, but not contribute with, you know, the carnage and the destruction that you helped architect. Because war, you know, creates orphans, and war creates a lot, you know, a great deal amount of pain. And I think that whether the victor or the one defeated have to bear in the responsibility of the situation, because otherwise there's no moving forward. Otherwise, what you have is the situation where, you know, post-colonial, I would say, you know, Europe, North Africa, where you always have, you know, the all colonial power being resented by the former colony, and you don't move from those dynamics. And it's very dangerous, because, you know, it breeds terrorism, it breeds instability and resentment. It's not healthy, because we live in an intra-connected world. We have to live together. So if we don't deal with this situation, it's, you know, it's almost similar to a bad case of divorce, where people have to go to therapy. Yeah. But I think we need therapy when it comes to Iraq and the United States. I mean, the Washington has to say, yes, we messed up. How can we help you fix it?
Yeah, no, I hear you. The UNICEF statement says the state of Iraq's healthcare system is alarming. For pregnant women, newborn babies, and children, preventable and treatable conditions can quickly escalate into a matter of life and death. Medical facilities are strained beyond capacity, and there are critical shortages of life-saving medicines. Now, Iraq used to have, whether one loved or loathed Saddam Hussein, and I'm certainly no apologist for Saddam Hussein's politics, but Iraq fundamentally had a free healthcare system and a functioning healthcare system, a system that the country was quite proud of before the first Gulf War. And then the U.S. imposed economic, through the UN, imposed economic sanctions. According to the UN, 8,000 people per month, that would be 5,000 children under the age of five, and mainly the other 3,000 were their grandparents, the very old, who were dying because they were not getting access to food and medicine. In other words, the more vulnerable parts of the population. We have a situation, Catherine, and Catherine Shockdom is our guest. She's an author and political commentator. We have, you know, people talk about the USA as the United States of amnesia. Gore Vidal originally coined that phrase. Other people have used it. But it seems to me, and this is one of the reasons why we want to do this show and shows like this, is that the amnesia is very dangerous, because it leads to a repetition of past mistakes or crimes. Right now, yeah. The Trump administration seems to be ratcheting up a confrontational position with Iran, Iraq's neighbor. And here we are, the specter of another possible confrontation in the Middle East. It's something people really have to be, I would say, seriously alarmed at, and not take in a sort of nonchalant way. Go ahead. We have 90 seconds left.
Those tensions in between Iran and the US are not new. But what scares me is that I think that Donald Trump is actually quite serious when it comes to war, because, again, he doesn't consider the consequences or even the possibility of a loss for America. Iran is not Iraq. Iraq was, post-sanctions broken up, and Iraq did not support its government. There's a huge difference with Iran. Iran is a military superpower. Iran is supported by Iranians. The government has popular legitimacy. And if America wanted to create a monster, then it should indeed attack Iran, and it would have a very bad surprise because, again, Iran is not flexing its military muscle right now, but it doesn't mean that it cannot. There's a difference in between a country that chooses peace because it doesn't believe in belligerence and a country that's self-defense. And I think that America needs to be very careful not awakening a dragon in Asia, because Iran is quite capable of defending itself. It doesn't want to, because he understands that war only breeds, suffering and misery for the people. They had 8 years war, with Saddam Hussein, which the US supported, by the way. I think it would be a grave mistake when Iran wants peace and the region needs Iran for stability.
I agree with you, Catherine. We've been joined from London by Catherine Shakhdam, a political commentator and analyst who focuses on the Middle East. She is the author of A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. According to multiple reports, Israeli police authorities are recommending to the country's Minister of Justice that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be indicted on myriad corruption and bribery charges. The recommendation was made unanimously by a panel of police chiefs. We are joined from Washington by Miko Pellet. He is the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko Pellet has a new book that is out next month called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko Pellet, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining. Miko, help the audience, which probably doesn't know, well, maybe some do, but not too many know, why Netanyahu is facing corruption charges. Will he be charged? And what would it mean for his political future as prime minister?
Well, it's all about the politics. The police have not made they've not made the recommendation yet. And right now Netanyahu is busy throwing all kinds of accusations against the police chief who he nominated, because the police chief said that senior police officers who are involved in the Netanyahu investigation have been subject to all kinds of surveillance by people close to Netanyahu. So now there is this back and forth, and the police chief, it was nominated by Netanyahu. He comes from the Shabak, the Israeli secret police, and was hoping to go back and be chief of Shabak, which is a much safer job. But now he's caught in this thing. Netanyahu is very strong politically. I would be surprised, even if there are recommendations, I'd be surprised if this affects him, in any way, shape, or form, even though the sharks are in the water just waiting for a drop of blood. wanting to take a seat, the things that he's accomplished for Israel in terms of recognition of Jerusalem, in terms of relations with the Arab and Muslim countries, this new deal coming up with Saudi Arabia, and really we're talking about corruption. We're not even talking about that much money. We're talking about influence, favors, and maybe a few $100,000, as far as I can see, as far as what's being revealed here. But I think what is incredibly interesting here is the interest in the corruption charges, where this man is really guilty of and should be charged with genocide. He should be charged with what is happening in Gaza, 2 million people dying a slow death without water, without medical care, without nutrition, thousands of political prisoners. Yet everybody around the world seems to be interested in this corruption charge. I mean, there's nothing really unique about a corrupt politician, particularly not an Israeli prime minister. So many of them have been charged with corruption. And this whole issue of the genocide, the murder, the slow killing, and the ongoing killing, actually shooting of young Palestinians every single day that we see on the streets, which is also, no longer news. I think this is a distraction. I don't think it's that important. I don't think it's going to affect Netanyahu. He's very strong politically. And again, I think it's a distraction from what's really important, which is that it doesn't matter if Netanyahu stays prime minister or leaves office. Whoever comes after him is going to be exactly the same. The genocide will continue. The ethnic cleansing of Palestinians will continue. The killing of young Palestinians who dare to stand up and protest will continue. So I think that's probably the more interesting part of this of the story.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I mean, this kind of mirrors what goes on in U.S. politics as well. You had Richard Nixon, for instance, carpet bombing Vietnam and killing more than 1 million Vietnamese and tens of thousands. The greater bulk of the American war dead came in the last 4 years of the war. That was during the Nixon era. But Nixon was not brought down for the war. He was brought down as a consequence of covering up or lying about a break-in to the Watergate Hotel. You have Bill Clinton impeached because he lied to Congress about having sexual relations with someone in the Oval Office, but not about the bombing, the dropping 28,000 bombs on Yugoslavia. I mean, it mirrors the same thing. In other words, the real issues of criminality become non-issues, and then these minor issues, or they might not be minor, but they certainly in the scope of things become minor. Let's talk about a little bit more about what Netanyahu's strategy is. You mentioned because he's, quote, done so much for Israel, the U.S. is now recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. We have the realignment of Middle East countries, the Arab countries, Egypt and Saudi Arabia with Israel. Talk about that relationship and how that's playing out, and whether or not that's the initiative of Netanyahu, the initiative of the Israelis, or does it come from Washington?
Well, you know, the Arabs call this the they call it the deal of the decade, which is this this deal between Washington, and it's probably the son-in-law Kushner who's behind it, Netanyahu, and the Saudi crown prince that have decided to reshape the Middle East. They will impose some kind of a peace deal on the Palestinians. They will push Palestinians from Gaza into the Sinai. They've got all these grand plans, which, of course, will come to nothing because the Palestinians aren't going to move. But in terms of his stature as a politician, Netanyahu has accomplished more, and he makes all the other politicians look like silly children, you know, in the playground. They can't even come close to him with what he's done. The recognition of Jerusalem was an enormous, enormous political gift from Trump to Netanyahu. This deal with, they had an Air India plane coming to Tel Aviv, fly over Saudi Arabia for the first time. In other words, Saudis allowed a plane going to Israel, flying to Israel, to fly over their airspace for the first time. You know, these are huge things, and Israelis really care for these things. Public opinion is formed by these things. And there's no Israeli politician who can come close to what he's done, who can claim any accomplishments even remotely similar to what Netanyahu can accomplish. And he's a strong and well, well-versed politician. I don't think he's going to come down, because this is not going to take him down. And if anything, the person that looks weak now and vulnerable is the Israeli police chief who was in charge of this and was saying clearly that there's clear evidence of surveillance against top Israeli investigators who are looking into the case, into Netanyahu's corruption case. So now the Israeli papers are only talking about that. Who's right, who's wrong, who's a good guy, who's a bad guy. Is the police chief right, is Netanyahu right? I mean, everything is gone. And in a way, he's mirroring what Trump is doing. You know, you throw trash at the accuser, you throw trash at the investigator, and you raise doubt at their integrity, at their ability to investigate and make it sound like it's all politics. So I don't think that this is going anywhere. I don't think we have any reason to celebrate. And besides, like I said, even if Netanyahu does go by some stroke of chance, and this brings him down, whoever comes in and takes his place is not going to change anything. It's not going to make anything any better in terms of what's really important, which is the freedom for Palestinians and freeing of all of Palestine and so forth. That's not going to change one way or the other.
Okay, in our last 2.5 minutes, Mikko Peled, let's talk about that issue, about the freedom or justice for Palestinians. We have all around the world a growing movement for the boycott, divest, sanctions. Obviously, the Israeli government and its, you know, I don't know, the people it influences here in the United States and elsewhere are very, very alarmed that this peaceful movement could, from the grassroots up, change the political dynamics. And it, in some ways, even though you have, as Israel does, or America does, or South Africa had, a huge military, seemingly omnipotent military force against its nearby rivals, what happens in public opinion actually does matter. The politics do shape the political climate and affects all the actors. In our last 2 minutes, just talk about, because I know you're very active with the boycott, divest, sanctions movement, what's going on, what's the latest, and what do we expect in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I think that it's actually comical in a way, because Israel just banned 20 organizations from, or members of 20 organizations, including some Jewish organizations, including the Quakers, you know, the American Friends Service Committee, Code Pink. And what's funny is about 2 weeks after the Code Pink was added to the list, the leaders of Code Pink went and visited Palestine, and they went right in and right out. Nobody even noticed. So they're not as, the Israelis are not as smart or effective as they think they are. And they're fighting a battle that they can't possibly win. I mean, you can't keep everybody out. You know, they're trying to legislate against the boycott movement. They're trying to pass legislation everywhere and make it illegal. And I'm looking at this thing that somebody just posted, I'm just completely randomly, that says apartheid was legal, the Holocaust was legal, slavery was legal, colonialism was legal. Legality is not really the issue. Legality is a matter of power. It doesn't mean that it's just or it's right. So even if every state in the United States and in Europe, you know, legislate and determine that boycotting Israel is illegal, it won't make any difference. It's still the right thing to do, and it's still going to prevail. There's no question about that.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Miko Peled. He is the author of The General Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko Peled has a new book that will be out next month called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we're going to take a look at the worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Patt. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Steve, you've come up this week with a great list. Why don't you start with your favorite one?
Well, my favorite one actually comes from the Voice of America, but you could find similar headlines elsewhere. It's from James. It's a quote from James Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis. And here's the quote: "Self-defense attack." This is regarding the attack in Syria, which either killed 100 people or wounded 25, depending on whether you believe the U.S. military or the Russian military.
This is the Pentagon's attack on Syrians.
Exactly. Thanks for the clarification. And here's his claim: self-defense attack doesn't mean U.S. getting into Syrian civil war.
Because when America kills Syrians as part of the Syrian civil war, they're not getting involved. They just kill people. It's just like, whatever. That's just absurd.
Right. Yeah. Among other things, he's right. It doesn't mean they're getting involved. They've been involved for years now. That's point number one. And point number two is you don't have a right to self-defense when you're in it illegally occupying another country. That's just ludicrous.
Right. I think the UN speaks to what self-defense means, doesn't it? It means unless you don't have a right to strike another member state except in the instances of imminent attack. Clearly, Syria is not involved in carrying out an imminent attack or even a future attack of the United States.
Just like Iraq wasn't in 2003. Nobody seems to focus on these issues, though. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. A related headline from CNN, which also got me there on the same strike, was U.S.-led coalition strikes kill pro-regime forces in Syria. And I just wanted to make the point, which could be made every week, that U.S. enemies are never governments. They're always regimes. So it wasn't a pro-government forces that were killed in Syria. It was pro-regime forces. This is just typical of the kind of propaganda that comes out under the radar, so to speak. Just it's routine.
I like Nikki Haley's comments about Venezuela. Read that headline.
That was my favorite, actually.
Yeah. She doesn't believe in democracy because she says Maduro's snap election will destroy Venezuela's democracy.
How dare he call an election?
Yeah.
How undemocratic can you get?
Yeah, apparently she's never heard that snap elections are routine in countries which don't have, you know, regular elections, like, for example, England, where Theresa May just called a snap election and suffered the consequences, as it turned out. Snap elections are normal, but not according to Nikki Haley. They're an affront to democracy.
And let's remember, this comment and this headline from Nikki Haley also comes after Rex Tillerson called on, and the U.S. government is now affirming it, for the, and Marco Rubio, in a tweet this morning, said the same thing, that the U.S. favors a military dictatorship in Venezuela.
Rubio actually came out and said that?
Yeah, it's a tweet.
He Good said, grief. This is where we've come in this country.
But let me ask, does this mean that, one, that America's meddling in other countries' elections? And two...
No, of course not.
No. And also, what about the idea that Maduro's snap election will destroy Venezuela's democracy, but the Secretary of State calling for a military takeover of a democratically elected government, that doesn't destroy Venezuelan democracy? I mean, the obvious double standard and hypocrisy in this case, I would say, would be breathtaking. Let's talk about Korea, because right now Korea and North and South Korea relations are dominating, because North Korea and Kim Jong-un's sister are at the Olympic Games in South Korea. I mean, the first time a member of the Kim family has gone to South Korea. South Korea was created by the South and North were created by the partition of Korea, as a consequence of the U.S. and the Soviet Union agreeing to a line of demarcation along the 38th parallel. One zone north of the 38th parallel would be under the influence and control of the Soviet Union. Soviet troops left in 1948. The other zone would be under the control of the United States. U.S. military forces here, 1945, okay, that would be 73 years ago. U.S. troops are still in South Korea. But let's talk about this headline. I mean, Kim Jong-un's sister is in South Korea. Lots of attention paid to it. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, the headline reads, "All swagger and smiles, Kim Jong-un's mysterious sister gets her star turn at the Winter Olympics." And just to note the opening sentence of this article, she arrived by private jet, as, of course, did every dignitary at the Olympics, no doubt. And she swaggered and smiled her way through the airport, and it was clear she was here to steal the show. So says Yahoo Sports, who's courtesy of this headline.
But and this is not only, I mean, this is pure sexism, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, she's a woman. She's a leading female political force inside the North Korean government. So when she comes and she shows confidence and dares to smile, it's all about arrogance and swaggering through the airport. Like, what is she supposed to do? Go ahead.
Right. And of course, at the end, the article lets us know she enjoys shopping in Paris.
Yeah. Also constant sexist references that are just, you know, these are commonplace, but because other media don't do, like, what's bad about the media, it's not jumping out. I mean, I want to actually read the first words. You have sort of paraphrased it. She arrived via private jet, and as Kim Jo-young swaggered and smiled through Incheon International Airport as the first member of her family to walk on South Korean soil in nearly seven decades, it was clear she was here to steal the show. Well, maybe she was there to build diplomacy between North and South Korea and not have a war.
Yeah, because she is a North Korean government official.
A top official.
She happens to be Kim Jong-un's sister, but she's also a senior government official.
Right. And by the way, she's already doing that as far as meeting with Moon Jae-in. Unlike Mike Pence, who's doing his best to disrupt any diplomatic overtures that are happening in Korea. So, I mean, she's doing good work while she's there.
I want to go on with this this article, which I find to be despicable, yet it quickly belonged. This is the article, yet it quickly belonged. South Korea had waited years for this day, the opening ceremonies of the Winter Games here in the mountains near its eastern coast. Yet it quickly belonged to the most unlikely of visitors, the kid's sister of Kim Jong-un, the dangerous dictatorial leader of North Korea, the isolated, heavily sanctioned, nuclear-armed rogue nation that sits on the other side of a demilitarized zone. I mean, oh my God, this is so bad. And yet it's the front page of Yahoo News. That's the front page. Yeah.
I'd like to turn to a related headline, which comes from The Hill, which is on the slightly more serious note. And this headline reads, disarmament official, colon, North Korea may be only months away from ability to strike U.S. with nuke. Now, there's two things wrong with this headline. One thing, I'm not an expert. My opinion or my guess is that the factual headline is wrong. They're not months away from being able to strike the U.S. with a nuclear weapon. But that being said, I'm not an expert. But what's really wrong with this headline is that it focuses, as everything, all the similar headlines do, on the wrong thing. The implication of this headline is that as soon as they're ready to strike the U.S. with a nuclear weapon, they'll do so. There's no emphasis in the headline or in the article about why they would do so, or more likely, more reasonably, why they wouldn't do so in a million years.
Yeah,
and it's headlines like this, which are precisely why the guy in Hawaii who sent out that false alert, that's why he's conditioned to think that it was perfectly reasonable that
North Korea
had just randomly shot a missile at Hawaii, because he's reading headlines like this, which says they might do it, they might do it.
Steve Pat, I'm going to jump in. We have 2 minutes left. I want to go to real quickly in the last 2 minutes to two headlines. One that you listed, White House spokesman, Trump has not focused on the stock market. What?
Yeah, this is my funny headline for the week. By my count, Trump has tweeted 50 times about the stock market. I read another article which got a count of 60 times, and of course he's spoken about it an equal number of times.
He took complete credit for it, but now that it's crashing, yeah. Trump has not focused on the stock market. Well, not in the last 48 hours, maybe. Okay, yeah. 1 minute left. I love this one. Russians penetrated U.S. voter systems, DHS cybersecurity chief tells NBC. What's wrong with that headline, Steve Pat?
Well, what's wrong is they did no such thing. They did, someone, possibly from Russia, did attempt to access voter rolls of various states, but none of them were accessing the voter systems, i.e. the voting machines, which the article also talks about. Penetrating voting machines. There was no such thing happened.
The other thing that the headline would fail to mention is that when the states, the 21 states or the DHS cybersecurity chief said had their systems hacked, when they asked for how to prevent a future attack, the DHS turned around and said, sorry, we can't help you. You don't have security clearance.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's a grave threat to American democracy, but we can't help you get your security clearance in order. Get back to us about that.
Right.
Anyway, John Kiriakou, I think the time goes so fast,
yeah,
but we're
out of time. Unfortunately, joining us from San Francisco was Steve Pat. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature on his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. It's a lot of fun. Check it out. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast on iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.